Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Mullen, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Simon Schuster, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, Jim Murray, the president of AT&T Michigan, will be joining us on the podcast. But first, we had some big news over the weekend, the shooting in Orlando. And I wanted to bring this up because of the response from Donald Trump. We teased this last week that we're going to talk about Donald Trump, but his reaction to the shooting was, a little unusual. John, why does it always got to be about him anyway? Because he told us this was going to happen.
Apparently, and that was the first thing that he tweeted was, but he doesn't want congratulations for being right. He just wants us to be strong and vigilant.
Because this is just the beginning, right? And if we keep letting Muslims come into the country, we're going to have second generation shooters. Does this, I'm just going to say this around the table, does this kind of stuff help or hurt Trump? Because, it gets him out there saying things that there are folks in this country who believe it, but on the other hand, it's so out there. It's so almost ridiculous.
I think it's starting to hurt him. I think when you look at this sort of combined with what the week he had before, where he criticized this Indiana-born judge, it kind of really raises questions for people. If you look, I believe The Hill came out with a poll over the weekend that shows he's already down 11 points to Hillary Clinton. And she's only been the declared nominee for a few days. I think people are looking at him. They're really questioning whether he's got the temperament to be president of the United States. I mean, there's times when you need to pause. There's times when you need to wait for the fact. There's times when you need to have a thoughtful, well-articulated response to a crisis like this. And I don't know that we'd ever get that from a President Trump.
And for as much as we keep thinking that this is going to happen, it seems like the Republican Party has kind of subdued him at times and made him appear mainstream. And then things like this happen, guys, and just reverts back to old Donald Trump again.
I think it's been clear that Trump has risen to prominence and captured the nomination by really securing these demographics of white working class voters. I think that he's really moving into the general election. He's going to have one of two options, and that is he can do what they call the pivot and move to a more centrist stake and try to embrace more demographics that can get him elected. Or he can either dig in stakes and try to really secure the white working class vote and build a level of enthusiasm that we haven't seen in a number of cycles in terms of turnout among those demographics. And the statements that he's making in regards to the Orlando shooting seem to indicate that he's really looking to dig in stakes when he says that Obama has something else in mind in regards to these attacks and that he refuses to mention radical Islam and that there's something going on. I think that this shows a man who's really trying to secure a specific base and is not looking to go for this pivot that Politico seem to be mentioning a lot.
And I don't even know, though, Jacob, if he's trying. I just think that this is just him, right? He just kind of speaks off the cuff.
Yeah, we can sit here and try to be smart and be like, oh, maybe he's going to pivot, maybe he can do this. But if there's anything that we've learned, it's that this is extremely unpredictable, an extremely unpredictable election, an extremely unpredictable electorate. And whether he's going to pivot or not, he's just going to say Donald Trump things, which is what he just did. And I like what John said. Perhaps maybe there was a lot of backlash, even from his own party, where I guess the jury's out of whether people are rallying behind him or not, about this judge thing. And that was got a lot of backlash from that. So perhaps maybe a general election audience is now paying more attention. So we'll see if he does try a pivot or if he's going to continue to do whatever he wants.
Okay, so last week we kind of teased this. We didn't get to it, but I really wanted to talk about, is Donald Trump a creation of the media? Did the media create Donald Trump? I want to get you guys' opinion on this, John, because the thought is if we never covered him, then he wouldn't be as popular as he is now. This is a chicken or the egg kind of argument, isn't it?
Well, it is, because you're going to cover him because he's a major party candidate. He's also a reality TV star, so there's a lot of traction there. Those arguments are always so false, though. It's like we sit around as the media and we're kingmakers. We cover the race and we cover the dynamics of the race. We cover who's got the groundswell, and that's what we do. That's what we did in this case. He just happens to be, a candidate that knows how to, as I put it, strum the chords that people want to hear, particularly people in the Republican primary at the time, and that's why he got the coverage he got.
I'm trying to be as balanced here as possible. So obviously as a journalist, my initial reaction is we report on what's going on. We're a reflection of what's happening. But there's only so much you can control in this day and age, especially on social media. A lot of stories and things like that now are driven by what is trending on social media, what people want to hear. But if we're running with the theory that the media created Donald Trump, what I can see backing that statement up is Donald Trump making a bunch of ridiculous statements, which he does, knowing that they'll be covered, because that's what we do. Journalism, we've always, one of our tasks is to point out questionable things that our potential leaders say. So is it that Trump is playing into this, feeding into this, using that simply to get his name out there? And so it's one thing that he gets his name out there, and it has resonated with the space he has out there too. So if you want to go with the theory that the media created Donald Trump, that could be perhaps your rationale to kind of explain why we have this dynamic.
Okay, so Simon, yes or no, did the media create Donald Trump?
No, I don't think so. But I mean, I think it's also important to realize that in modern politics, in a sense, optics is extremely important to them. And I think for Donald Trump, a very different set of rules in terms of that realm of political engagement is just completely written off.
You know, I think there is something to be said. Did the media create Donald Trump? Well, maybe in a way, but it's only because we cover what people are interested right. in reading about, what they're interested in seeing. I mean, are they interested in seeing more about George Pataki? All right, let's go back in time. Let's rewind the clock a year, okay, and thinking about the 15 people who are running for president. I mean, is it fair to think that we're going to give as much attention to George Pataki and some of these other candidates as we are going to give to Donald Trump? No, because we realize at an early stage that he's not a viable candidate. Now the media is determining who's viable candidates. No, I understand. But take a look at this. Who is supporting folks like George Pataki? Nobody. Nobody was supporting him. He had no money. He hadn't been in office in forever. He brought nothing to the table. What were people talking about? Even a year ago, guys, we were talking about Donald Trump and what a fool he is. Hey, look, everybody, what a fool he's making of himself. Oh, wait a minute. People actually like this.
Yeah, no, and that's a good point, Kyle, because, you know, I think there's always an argument like, yeah, we need to cover everyone equally. But is that really a reflection of reality? I mean, you might do a profile on Pataki and just let people know what he's doing. That's our duty. But again, like, it's a reflection of what's happening. That's news judgment, right? If we're writing stories like Pataki is a viable candidate, what does that show? How does that show our news judgment of like what's important? So
I know it would seem like we're out of touch.
Yeah, and right? So covering things equally just for the sake of making them equal is not a reflection of reality. So that can at least be something that we can kind of point to and say, yeah, like this is a reflection of what is going on in our political spectrum right now.
Like that governor from Virginia, I even forgot his name.
Gilmore?
Yeah, Happy Gilmore, right? I mean, we could have given him equal coverage, but nobody was supporting him. He had a spaghetti dinner in New Hampshire with two people showed up after, you know, the results. I mean, it's just not the same thing at all.
And there was a story about that, so we do know about that.
Right, exactly. But it was just the story about how pathetic he was.
Well, I think that in the internet era, especially in the internet era of news, news has become, especially about politics, much more a marketplace of ideas than it's ever been before. And there's a broad swath of the American public that has a lot of these nativist, kind of nationalistic leanings. And the fact that neither party has really played into those inclinations in the past 10, 15 years, I think speaks to the fact that both of them were out of touch with a message that is really resonating with a considerable portion of the American population. And I think Donald Trump's ascendancy and our inability to see that coming is a result of how out of touch we were with it as well.
I just think it's hilarious that people out there actually consider that the media is some kind of unified, centrally controlled, that we are setting the stage and we are creating the agenda, that there's this kind of master plan. It's just kind of an indication of where we're at in our political thought process.
There is, but you will admit, though, John, there is a herd media mentality.
Oh, there's
out there.
Always
I mean,
that,
sure. And that's not
sure. But you know, having worked with reporters for 20 years, I mean, I can tell you that there's not that much coordination.
we don't all sit around and talk about what we're going to cover, do we?
We don't.
In fact, we do that for strategic reasons. We don't want it to know.
We're not kidding. We're not getting marching orders from the mothership somewhere of journalism. You know, I mean.
We don't. I mean, we follow what everyone's doing, but we don't want to share what we're going to be doing.
Right. It just makes me laugh because it's this conspiracy theory writ large.
All right. Well, let's move on here to the interview portion of the podcast. I'm joined right now by Jim Murray, the president of AT&T Michigan. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Thanks for having me, Cal.
Well, let's talk about this session we just got done with. We did Detroit Public Schools, and it was certainly not a bipartisan moment here for this legislature. You've been around this town for quite a while. What were kind of your perceptions as you saw this go through the process?
Well,
well, you know, I mean, it's governing, right? I mean, you work until you get to that 56th vote and or the 20th vote, and it's you can be as bipartisan as you need to be, as you have to be. And the House hasn't needed to be bipartisan. They've got the troops lined up, and they've got the votes, and they're solidly behind their speaker, and the Senate's got their supermajority. So whoever's side doesn't win is will scream partisanship. But basically, once you get to that 56th vote, it doesn't matter how many are Democrat, how many Republicans, as long as you have that governing majority.
Now, you were around this town when Engler was in charge, and we had a Republican House and Senate. Do you remember things being pretty partisan back then?
Yeah, I'm sure that they were. I mean, some of it's all a blur. Engler, I think, would go to that 56th vote too, right? I mean, and I remember the House. I remember we overturned him once.
On a veto.
Yeah, on a veto. So I mean, you know, Engler had a different style than Snyder does, of course, and then again, what Granholm had, and the partisanship can either be in the back room or it can be out in MERS, and it seems a lot more that it's out in the media more than it is behind the scenes.
Is that because of social media and just more media? What do you
think? I think that and, you know, term limits. You know, you just have a different type of legislator that comes in here every 6 years. And all of those things equal together equal to be a little bit more partisan, I think.
Do you think that the rhetoric that we heard from the Democrats was more of a political nature, or do you think that this was a bit different in the way that it was delivered, maybe a bit more sincere?
I was talking with a Democrat friend yesterday in the House, and they were upset about what happened. And we said there will be another hot issue in 2 months that will get all fired up, right? I mean, at some point you got to move on, and you know, okay, let's go to the next issue. Energy's coming up; you can get all excited about energy, and there will be another issue that pops up that will get everybody all excited. So you can either dwell on it and be upset and not be productive, or you can say, okay, we lost this one. Move on. What's next? Because something will come down the pike next.
Is there something the Democrats could have done to maybe get a more favorable package here?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I was, me and AT&T, we supported the Detroit Education Commission. We supported that, and we thought that was something that we would like to see. But, you know, at the end of the day, they passed a package that they think is going to work, and we got to give it an opportunity to work. So I don't know if the Dems could have done anything different other than, you know, it takes two to be bipartisan, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they could be bipartisan too. They could have said, hey, wait, you know, we would like to be a part of this, and here's some things that we can, you know,
support.
And I don't know that kind of discussion actually has gone on.
And is that anybody's fault in particular, or is that both sides' fault?
I think it's both sides' fault. I think just as the Speaker and his leadership team could go over to the Democrats and try to get votes if they needed to, the Dems can go over there and say, this is something that's really important to me, and I want this to be in the package. And if it's in the package, I'll be with it. I may not like everything. So, yeah, it is a two-way street. And, you know, and until they need to have Democrat votes, they probably won't have bipartisanship. It's really that easy. It's just that 56 number.
Right, exactly. Or the 20 number. Or right. 19 right now in the Senate, since they have a vacancy that they have to go on. Speaking about partisanship, do you feel like the legislature this time around is any more partisan than any other legislature? Is that just kind of come with the territory?
I think it comes with the territory. I don't think they're any more partisan than they used to be in the past. Like I said, it may be a little bit more out in the public more than it had been in the past, but I think the partisanship's over there. It's a political town. We elect people on political tickets. You know, that's what happens. There's different philosophies, and you know, and then even within each party, there are different ways of governing, and I just think that's just an inherent nature of the beast.
Taking a look ahead here, there isn't going to be a lot of session between now and the election. We counted 11 days for both the House and the Senate. We're not going to be expecting anything of real significance between now and then. We may actually have a summer this year.
Yeah, I think you probably will get the summer. I mean, yeah, there's 11 session days, but you know, they can always add more, and if the House did flip in November, I suspect you'd see a pretty active lame duck.
Yeah, I would think so. In fact, the Senate Majority Leader even scheduled tentative session all the way up to 3 days before Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah, really.
That wouldn't be very good. But then again, if the House is able to stay Republican, that could be trimmed pretty significantly.
Yeah, I would think you're probably down to your 11 session days.
Taking a look at what something else that passed this past session, Tom Barrett and Vanessa Garrett supported a bill that AT&T was behind Talk about this bill.
Yeah, we've been doing this across the country. We have some model legislation in terms of domestic abuse instances where the spouse that leaves, they can get a court order or some a PPO or some kind of legal instrument that would allow them to get off the family plan and get onto their own plan more quickly than they would be able to then going through the normal divorce or whatever process.
Right, and this is something you said that you've seen across the country as well, and this is really as a protection, probably some response that you've gotten back from your own customers.
Yeah, I don't know where it started in the country, but I'm sure that we did have some instances where we saw that this is a legitimate need for them to come off the plan, but just because of the legally binding contracts that we have on the group plans and the minutes and all that kind of stuff, that we needed some kind of way to be able to let that person off their contract. And so this is pretty good legislation that I don't think had any resistance. In fact, I think it passed from introduction to the governor's desk in about 3 weeks.
That's pretty fast in this town.
Yeah, it is.
Well, and this is an opportunity for both sides to come together on an issue that...
And this was a bipartisan piece of legislation.
Sure. And one that should really probably have no opposition anyway. So, and something else that you're involved in I thought was really interesting is, I call it the Blue Cross Blue Shield Endowment Fund, but I know that's not what it's called. But I think of it because this is the endowment fund that was set up after Blue Cross Blue Shield transitioned out of their nonprofit status. And so there's a big pool of money sitting there, and there's some legislation that moved or had a hearing on recently in regards to adding another word to what this money could be going toward. This was something you supported.
Yeah, I do. I wanted to be on the Michigan Health Endowment Fund when it was created because I thought that this was a way to put millions of dollars, extra dollars, into the social fabric that we have here in the state without using taxpayer money. There were a few limitations on what the money could be used for. There are some enumerated items that you can use it for, infant mortality, you know, things like that. And this bill would only add public health emergency to that list of things that we could use it for.
Now, public health emergency, the bells in my head is screaming Flint.
Yeah, exactly. The philosophy that I had for the endowment fund when I joined was, you know, we could use this money from Thanksgiving to New Year. We could fill every food kitchen in the state. You know, we could buy coats for kids for everybody. And then, you know, Flint happened, and I firmly believe that we should be using every dollar that we have that's not encumbered. You know, we have some Medigap coverage that we have to do, and we have administration that we have to do. But I think it all should go to Flint, every dollar.
Now, how much money is that?
It's in the tens of millions. I don't know specifically how much we have to use for the Medigap, because we've got a board meeting on that in a couple of weeks that I think we'll get that exact figure. But, you know, we get about $50 million each year from Blue Cross, each year. And, you know, you take away what we got to do for Medigap, you take away what we got to do for the administration of the fund. And there's a lot of worthwhile organizations out there that apply for this money. But I think we have this instance in Flint where we have to do all we can to help. And this would be tens of millions of dollars that we could use that do not have to come from the taxpayer, do not have to come from the city that can't afford it. And I think we ought to be doing it. After we take away the obligations that we have, I think we ought to use every single dollar towards Flint. And the majority leader and Cole Wall and Jim Ananick put this bill in, and I like it. I like the fact that it doesn't require us to do anything, but it allows that to be one of the uses that we use the fund for.
Now, some could argue that since this was a state-created issue, that the state should have to pay for it, we shouldn't have to use these kind of special pots for...
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to, you know, I mean, I do think the state should have a responsibility in this, but we do have this out there where we don't have to use this money to replace the pipes, but we can use this money for the health of the children there. We can use this money to feed. We can use this money for health care. We can use this money for, you know, whatever actions come as a result of the lead poisoning, long term, too, you know, long after everybody takes their eye off Flint and it starts to rebound, there's still going to be some health repercussions. Then I think that this is a good pot of money to do that. I don't know why we would force the state to use resources that it would take from other items when we do have this availability out there.
Your executive director, Paul Hilligans, who seemed to think that this bill was unnecessary.
Maybe it is. I mean, maybe we don't have to be told specifically that we can use this money for Flint, but that doesn't mean that we should oppose it. They have a strategic plan that was created that doesn't involve using health endowment fund money for public emergencies. But you know what? 10 years down the line, something may happen, and we want to do it. So I fully support having it there.
Jim Murray's the president of AT&T Michigan. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Kyle.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to John Rurig, Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler, and Jim Murray, of course, for coming in. And Simon, I got to see this new watch here. You might have heard about the state surplus sale that was going on. Our Simon Schuster was there, and he was not covering it for anything. But it sounds like it was a mob scene.
No, I went there at about 8:45 a.m. Look, as just a regular citizen looking for a good deal, and I found quite a few.
All right, so you've got this watch.
Yeah, this is a $150 fitness tracking watch that they had on sale in the surplus store for the measly sum of $5. And so I picked this up along with a couple of others that are worth a pretty penny.
Oh, wait, other watches?
I did. I got
three. You only
three.
Have two wrists.
So I know.
What are you going to do with three watches if you have two wrists?
A man has to coordinate, Kyle.
Wow.
We'll take that line out.
I was going to say, Simon, your story is convincing me to go to the surplus sale next year. I think that would be a very interesting pitch. I know the state sends out a press release each year. I think I would go with that pitch, getting a $150 watch. For $5 as a kind of a pitch for the surplus sale, for sure.
You would be amazed what people will surrender at airports and lose at government buildings, Jacob.
So you also bought a corkscrew?
Yes, they also had wine bottle openers there on sale, 5 for $1. And I tried buying one and they wouldn't let me, and they told me I had to take 4 more.
Well, wait a minute now. What are you going to do with 5 wine openers? You really only need one.
Find friends with a lot of unopened wine bottles, I assume.
Did they have that many wine bottle openers that they had to sell them in a pack?
I think TSA doesn't allow the corkscrews on airplanes.
Oh, my goodness. I guess I could see that. All right, John's nodding his head. You've gone on the airplane more than I have lately. All right. That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care. Don't bring me down.